Hi, so it's been a really awesome conference, very stimulating, lots of provocative questions to think about. I hope that this talk will provoke you to think even more about these things. So I've designed it kind of not as like, I'm not presenting any research that I've done. I'm just kind of using this as a soapbox to preach at you about the thoughts that have arisen in my own head throughout the course of the conference and that have been sort of brewing for a while. And the context for these thoughts is I'm based at UMass Boston. I'm working with the Cubism group, which is the group of Chris Fuchs. We also have a PhD student, John DeBrota, and there's also Blake Stacey, who's based there. And I guess my role there is kind of trying to think about how causality and cubism might go together. So I don't know if I'll get a chance to begin talking about causality. I only really have a couple of thoughts about that right at the end. Mainly, I want to give some general thoughts about what is science and what is scientific reality, basically. Because in the end, I think that this is a question that's lurking behind a lot of our discussions here. You know, when we get lost in our operational kind of predictive mathematics, and then we become frustrated and say, but what does this mean? What kind of lesson should we draw from this about the world? And that's kind of what I want to put the emphasis on in this talk. But a big part of that is just framing that question and trying to understand, is that even a meaningful question? And if so, how should we go about trying to answer it? Obviously, I'm biased. I'm going to try and tell you that we should answer it the way that the cubists try to answer it. If you're interested to know more about cubism, one thing that I've learned, at least my own experience, is it's best not to start by reading cubists. There's a lot of stuff written by the cubists, but I never found it particularly enlightening. In my case, what started to convince me that there was sense to it was actually reading philosophy. So I can recommend William James, particularly his book Pragmatism, is probably the reference for cubists, philosophically speaking. I myself come from maybe a slightly different school of thought that's very related called phenomenology. So there's a great textbook called by Don Zahavi. It's called Phenomenology, the Basics. Very readable, easy to understand. There's also this book by von Baer. I can't say I'm a big fan of the title. It's a little bit, let's say, bombastic and overly optimistic. I would say, well, cubism, maybe the future of QM would be more accurate. I haven't read it, but Chris says that it's basically correct. So you could try that. The reason I put these books on philosophy here, besides that one, is that I think it's a better way into cubism, and it's something where if you find you're reading it and it's just not making sense to you or just sounds completely loony, you will save yourself a lot of trouble because you'll already know cubism isn't for you and you won't have to get lost in mathematics before you reach that point. And then to get more into cubism, this is a very important recent paper by Blake Stacey. You can find it on the archive, Cubism and Assumption Q. He also has some other papers which are worth looking at, which he's kind of the resident historian of cubism, so he keeps a careful chronology in his head about how the ideas in cubism have evolved. Because it's an evolving project, you can often find contradictory statements in the literature. And typically you'll find that stuff that Chris Fuchs was saying in, you know, or Rudiger Schack was saying in 2002 or 2007 are completely different to what they said after 2009. Things after 2009 are more or less stable, I would say, but it's important to keep that in mind when trying to make sense of the enormous literature by the cubists. So with that out of the way, let me launch into the main question. So really, the question is a good starting point, I would say, is a comment Lucian Hardy made in the opening remarks to this conference, which was something like quantum mechanics says that the world is intrinsically probabilistic. And this is something that I've heard many times from many people, not just at this conference, but in the quantum information community in general. The idea that what makes quantum mechanics special is somehow its intrinsic randomness. But I disagree with that, so I want to challenge that. In a certain sense, well, in a very clear sense, the world always was probabilistic. We were never certain about anything in our lives, what would happen. Even in the most classical experiments, there's always been a lot of uncertainty. You know, lots of correcting errors and second guessing and so on. So obviously, if it's true that quantum mechanics is about intrinsic randomness, that has to be qualified somehow. We can't take that statement at face value. So how do we qualify it to understand what we really mean when we say that? So I would suggest that what we really mean is that the world is random in a way that doesn't fit with classical randomness. With the sort of randomness we're used to prior to quantum mechanics somehow doesn't gel with the randomness we got after. Notice the subtle but important shift. Not a move from certainty to uncertainty, just a move from one structure of uncertainty to another. I think maybe it's a mistake to pose the problem of quantum gravity as a conflict between certainty and uncertainty, as is sometimes done. Because as a kind of heuristic way of thinking about science, we could say that our scientific theories have two jobs. Two jobs. The first part of a theory is the predictive part. And I'm going to put maybe a slash there with operational. But the idea is that they serve as, let's say, abstract frameworks that help us to predict what's going to happen. Of course, they're much more than that. We also, if we have a theory that works very well in the predictive aspect, we can take it as having an explanatory character. More than that, we can take it as a description. So this is not something unfamiliar. I mean, this is more or less how the history of science goes. We start in a state of uncertainty about the world. We notice certain patterns. We devise abstract mathematical theories to help us predict those patterns. And then we check those against observations. Finally, we reach a point of consensus whereby that structure begins to be taken as a description of how the world is, and it takes on its explanatory character. Why do I point out this perhaps glaringly obvious feature of science? Well, simply because when we pose quantum gravity as the conflict between the classical determinism of, say, general relativity and the apparent intrinsic randomness of quantum theory, we're really making a false comparison, because what we're really doing is we're comparing what the final product of our classical theorizing, which is the explanatory and descriptive part, which is obviously going to have a sort of deterministic and logically necessary character, with quantum theory, which in its current incarnation only really has a widely accepted operational or predictive character. So it would perhaps be more fair to make the comparison between classical gravity and, let's say, deterministic interpretations of quantum theory, say many worlds or de Broglie-Bohm mechanics. That would be a more fair way of comparing it. Or alternatively, one could take classical general relativity and consider it as an operational predictive theory, reformulate it as a sort of generalized probabilistic theory, and compare that to quantum theory. And that is also, I would say, a legitimate comparison. But there we can see that the comparison is not a conflict between determinism and probability, but rather between two different kinds of, or different structures of probability. So now I've taken that initial idea and transformed it into a comparison of different structures of uncertainty.
Yeah. The conflict with classical relativity is not about it being deterministic, but things like singularity, which is point-like object in classical GR, which, and we know in quantum theory, there is no point-like objects because of Heisenberg uncertainty, for instance. So these are the conflicts, not the fact that one is deterministic, the other is not, I think.
Well, I think it's fair to say there's many different ways of posing the conflict between classical and quantum. So what I'm proposing here is really just taking one, what I think was a not quite correct way of posing the conflict, and trying to transform that into a more correct reading of that way of posing it. But I agree that one could also reject that way of posing it altogether, and maybe think in the terms you suggest. But then I would say you're operating at the level of making a comparison of two descriptive or explanatory aspects of the theories. So in order to make a fair comparison, I would say you should compare, let's say, the point-like objects in classical theory with whatever you take to be the ontological or, you know, descriptive elements of quantum theory. And as we know, that's still something of an open problem. So what I would like to do is arbitrarily make the comparison on the second route, which is to, So I think what has been focused on by many people in the foundations community is thinking about operational probabilistic theories and thinking in those terms. But it's important also to ask the question, if we did want to ask, how do we get to the descriptive or explanatory content of quantum theory? How could we arrive at that? What would be an appropriate methodology for doing that? Now, it seems that the way that people have tried to do this in the past is really to try and import directly from previous classical theories, looking at the descriptive part of classical theories, to import features or ideas from those descriptive parts and then simply posit a new descriptive theory for quantum theory. But what I'd like to suggest is that we need to go back a further step and say, well, how was it that we arrived at the descriptive or explanatory part of classical theory in the first place? How was it that we went from our stage of being uncertain about what the world is like, even classically, and then arrived at this beautiful deterministic mathematical formulation of curved space-time and so on? And what we should do is understand that methodology and then apply it again from scratch to quantum mechanics. So the very first thing to think about when doing this is what's the kind of raw material that we start with? So how do we get to the description of quote unquote reality? I'll expand on those scare quotes in a moment. Well, the first thing that we can observe is that what we have before anything else are our perceptions. And it's important to make a distinction between what I would call like a raw perception and perception proper. So what I mean by that, by raw perception, is like what you see, what you taste, you know, what you feel, what you directly, viscerally sense. But when you perceive something like, you know, like a person or a chair or, you know, any mundane object, you perceive a lot more than what is present to your senses about it. For example, it comes together with a whole host of expectations about it. You know that you can walk behind it, and you expect that you know what it looks like behind. You expect that the table is solid, that you'll bump into it. All of these things mean that what you perceive proper is strictly more than what is given to you in your sensory perception. So perception proper is what I'm going to call the sort of raw material of science. This isn't particularly controversial, I hope. I mean, in the end, scientists have to start with what they themselves perceive in their experiments, and they have to make sense of that and eventually arrive at some sort of objective description of what's going on. So let's make a little cartoon of the scientific process. So the first step is that we do lots of experiments and we figure out which, for, you know, say we're investigating some phenomenon, we have to separate what are the variables relevant to that phenomenon and what are the variables that are purely contextual. So for example, if you're, you know, dropping weights of different masses, it's quite obvious that what you had for breakfast that day or what color your shirt is shouldn't matter. It's not scientifically relevant. And that's because you select certain variables to quantitatively measure, and you have a sort of recipe for doing this that can be followed by anybody. And if people do it under different circumstances in different locations or, you know, under other different contextual conditions, a lot of those different contextual details won't matter to the phenomenon of interest. So the first step is to separate the irrelevant context from, let's say, the relevant variables. And this is what we might call a scientific observation. When you write up what you observed in your experiment, we train students not to include things like if they felt happy or sad, or you know what color the lab bench was, and so on. And the second step is that even after we take account of that kind of contextual detail, there's another kind which is a bit more difficult to extract, which is that things given to us in perception are inherently perspectival. When you see a table, you see it only from a particular angle. So the next step is to factor out the observer. And we do this by splitting up the scientific observation into two parts. The first part is the frame of the observer. And what's left, we call the object. So the idea here is that we see if we can identify certain relevant features of the observer themselves, which once those are taken into account, what's left is something that can be identified by observers under a variety of different contexts and from a variety of different frames, but which appears the same once we factor out those that context and those frames. So this process produces, in the end, a world of scientific objects. Those are precisely those things that we now have a methodology for identifying and factoring out from both context and reference frame. Right?
process, is it not maybe an issue of circularity because it's kind of like theory ladenness of observation, right? So we observe things with microscopes, we assume that they're laws of quantum mechanics. And so it's not clear that you actually have the object, right? There's still some potential that...
Oh, certainly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to overly complicate things for this presentation, but yes, one can go into that. There is a certain bootstrapping that goes on in this whole procedure. But I want to call what's left over from this process scientific reality. So it's the observer-independent objects that we identify and their behavior. So once we know how to identify the objects, we can study how they change in time and so on and define the laws that describe that. So when I talk about a description here, what I mean is this scientific reality that emerges from this process. It's worth pointing out that it wouldn't be fair to diminish either the personal reality and that involves all these contextual details of the individual observers. So I qualify this by calling it scientific reality and not simply reality, because if you're in the lab doing a measurement and you stub your toe and it hurts, it seems really unfair to say that that's not real just because it's not part of the scientific object that you're studying or it's, So I think it's taking a pragmatic point of view, we should simply differentiate layers of reality or reality as seen from particular methodological points of view, if you like. But that's just an aside. Oh, well, yeah, okay. Got ahead of myself. Okay, so I want to emphasize that a feature of the scientific reality is that it's a common reality. It is meant to be valid for any person, anywhere, and at any time. And that's by construction exactly because in the process of eliminating what we call the irrelevant context, what we're doing is coordinating multiple different experiments under different conditions. So whatever is left over from that has to be independent. Has to be universal in a sense. So it may be true that we each begin from a kind of personal perceptual reality, But our realities are connected to each other and to the world that we all commonly inhabit, which is the scientific world. So the scientific reality is really nothing more or less than the reality of this kind of connective glue, the fact that we can communicate with each other, coordinate with each other, and thereby identify these invariant objects of our common experience. So turning to quantum mechanics, we can now ask why it stubbornly resists this usual process. With regards to the first step of separating the context from the relevant variables, the problem really begins because of the fact that the outcomes of quantum measurements depend not only on which measurement is performed, but also on what other measurements are performed in the same experiment. So we could say that the first problem is that QM is manifestly contextual.
Jack?
Yeah.
Certainly. I mean, it's not... Can you qualify that? Because it's not true. I mean, if you measure commuting observables, the outcome of one doesn't depend on the other. If you I mean, it's quantum mechanics is operationally not contextual. It's not true that the outcome of a measurement depends on the context. Only if you put some hidden variables or extra assumptions.
Right, because contextuality defined in the technical way is referred to some hidden variable model by definition.
Or some kind of ontological.
Yeah. No, what I meant here is something more, I shouldn't have used the term contexture here. Perhaps, but I couldn't think of a better word. What I meant is that if you take, for example, an experiment involving three measurements, and then you consider another experiment where you only do two of those measurements, it makes a difference whether in that second experiment you're simply doing that third measurement and ignoring the outcome, or whether you're actually not doing that third measurement. So what I really want to get at is that whereas classically you can arrange that ignoring the outcome of measurement is equivalent to not doing that measurement for the purposes of prediction, in quantum mechanics that's no longer true.
So you're talking about time-like separated measurements, because if you do this
in
a separate system, you can ignore and...
Yeah, that's right. I'm considering a general, let's say, sequential measurements and so on.
But the word for contextuality is something else.
Yeah, so... Maybe this, I should put scare quotes around it. I had in mind something that, do you want to ask?
Yeah, so just to clarify, so do you just essentially mean that measurements disturb if you remove the second measurement?
Well, yes, if you define it in a suitably operational way, because I want to stay at, for the moment, at the level of, at the operational level. But yes, that's basically what I mean.
Isn't that true classically, operationally as well?
True.
Yes, but the point is that we can set up our experiments classically to eliminate that effect. And quantumly, it seems that we can't. If we could, there wouldn't have been a problem. So I had kind of in mind that, Bohr had this problematic idea of complementarity, which he used to mean multiple different things, but I think there is a useful idea there, which is kind of that the phenomenon that you observe does depend somehow on the entire experiment that you're planning to do, and you can't just change one part of that and expect to carry over the rest of the phenomena.
So maybe, but still, experiments doesn't depend on which color your shirt is. So,
yes. So
I guess maybe it's just shifted. It's not that it's a problem with one, it's just that what is irrelevant or relevant context is somewhat shifted.
Well, yeah, so perhaps one isn't the most problematic aspect here. But it is, you know, one and two there are also somewhat connected to each other. So they're also not completely separable. And the second problem kind of informs that, which I would say is the problem of big no string. So in the case that we want to try and understand what is observed in terms of the frame of the observer and the observed object, we have the problem that if we try to presume that there is a definite fact about whether a measurement has occurred, we run into paradoxes. So when we have, you know, a hypothetical scientist who themselves is in a superposition, it seems that we can't at once presume that they have definitely made some measurement and got some outcome, and on the other hand, suppose that they are to be described by quantum superposition. We either have to do one or the other.
But quantum mechanics doesn't say that. The Figner strand is just it's something that we say, okay, maybe we can bend some rules and make an observer to be in superposition, but I don't think it's a problem of quantum mechanics. It's a problem of our problematic scenario.
Well, classically, it seems you can get away with supposing that someone has done a measurement, but you just don't know what it is.
Sure, but quantum mechanics doesn't say that the measurement, the observer can be in superposition with the subject. It doesn't say that. It gives some predictions, some...
You're saying it hasn't been demonstrated that if we try to make a Wigner's friend experiment that it will actually work.
No, I mean that quantum mechanics doesn't say that the observer has these tools and it predicts, and quantum mechanics says that this is the prediction, but it doesn't say that you can put the observer into superposition.
You're just saying I should be speaking at the operational level and not about the fact.
It's just that I don't see it as a problem of quantum mechanics. I see it as a problem of the person who did it.
In the name of time, maybe we should discuss after, but... Quick question.
I was pointing out maybe quantum mechanics plus reductionism gives it this trend, right? So
mm-hmm.
The trend made of atoms.
So. Okay, well, let's set this aside. But the point that I wanted to draw from the Wigner's friend thought experiment is that if we want to understand the different state assignments, or let's say the different phenomena observed by Wigner and the friend, and we want to understand that in terms of having different reference frames, but looking at the same scientific object, it's not at all clear how to do that. And I would posit that none of the works done here on quantum reference frames extend to that scenario. If I'm wrong about that, then let me know. But I think that's critical, because it means we still don't know completely how to identify the observer frame. And one aspect of that is that it seems, quantum mechanics seems to tell us that if there is some notion of observer frame, in this case, it's not simply the brute physical properties of the observer that are relevant. It rather has more to do with what that observer has actually perceived to have happened. That seems to be relevant, which is telling us that the observer frame, if there is one in quantum mechanics, is more like a kind of informational frame, if we could make sense of that idea. I'm not sure if we can. So I would suggest that maybe the act of changing reference frames should be thought not fundamentally as a physical transformation, but as a mental one, as an act of inference. So starting from the point of view that you have, you're trying to infer from the information you have and based on what you know about some other observer, trying to infer what you would see if you were in their shoes. And maybe if we think about reference frames in that way, we can extend to this kind of scenario. So I'd like to talk a little bit about cubism and really give you a kind of quick crash course. How much time do I have?
15 minutes, including questions.
Okay, that should be enough. Okay, so the ingredients of cubism in brief our subjective interpretation of probability. So what I mean by that is, I'll write out all of the ingredients first. So it's not an interpretation in the sense of positing a description of how the world is, but a methodology for finding such an interpretation. So it's an attempt to kind of maybe revise or reinterpret that scientific process in light of quantum mechanics, and hopefully in the future arrive at a picture of scientific reality through that process. And a key kind of point of departure is the rejection of the EPR criterion of reality. So the EPR criterion basically says that if, without in any way disturbing a system, you can be certain that it's in some eigenstate of some observer with, you know, eigenvalue x, then that corresponds to an element of reality of that system. Cubism rejects this and says, no, all that it means when you assign a state that's an eigenstate of some observable is that you're absolutely certain that if you measure that observable, you would get the value x. But this is fundamentally a statement about your subjective beliefs about what will happen if you do that measurement. In particular, you could turn out to be wrong. So nothing compels nature, if you like, to live up to your expectations of it. And cubism says that we shouldn't locate the correctness or incorrectness of a state assignment in whether it agrees with some externally existing reality that has some actual state. The correctness or incorrectness must first be located in how you update your beliefs in the light of new information. So for a cubist, making some probability assignment or some state assignment is not in itself right or wrong. What's right or wrong is how that changes when you learn something new. And the way that you're supposed to do this in, let's see. So suppose that H and E are some events that you're anticipating may happen. Now, ordinary probability theory tells us that these should be related by this rule, which is called Bayes' rule. And this is the result of what you might call just the laws of probability theory or logical necessity or simply coherence, internal coherence. So the subjective Bayesian would say the fundamental principle is to always strive for coherence in your beliefs. So if you assign these three probabilities, you should also assign this for the conditional probability. Because if you don't, your beliefs are simply inconsistent with each other. Now, there is a second type of coherence. So this type of coherence refers to your beliefs all at one time at which you're contemplating things. But now let's suppose that E happens. Now, how should your probabilities change in light of this new information? And the principle of Bayesian updating says that your new probability for H, let's put superscript new, should be equal to the old conditional probability that you had for H and B. It's important to distinguish this rule from this one. Because in fact, this is more what you would call a normative rule. So this can't really be derived from probability theory because it's comparing probabilities in two completely different contexts. On this side of the equation, the event E has actually happened, whereas this was some belief that you had at a time when E had not happened. So from as a matter of kind of philosophical principle, you might as well be in two completely different worlds. And there's no reason why your probability assignments in one of those worlds should carry over to the next one. In order to establish this connection, we posit rules like this one, which relate probability assignments in situations where there's some fundamental difference in the context. So every probability assignment is made implicitly in the presence of some background set of assumptions, which might include, let's say, your memories, things that have actually happened, maybe records of things. So if we were to make this explicit, we can put a little subscript B on all of these probabilities, where B is just equal to the background context in which you make these probability assignments. So these kind of rules are the domain of what I would call internal coherence. And now in this case, let's replace this new and old notation. Now we can see that on this side, we have a probability assignment made in that context, and now we have a new context, B, E. So now we have a rule of coherence relating to different sets of background contexts. And this kind of rule I want to call, let's say, coherence in the world.
So often when I'm in that situation, I have a probability for something given something else that might happen, and then the thing actually happens, and it reminds me of something, and so my probability doesn't obey this. So
yes.
It seems like often we don't operate upon.
Yes, exactly. So that's why rules of this type are a little bit more contingent than rules of that type. So these rules of coherence in the world are really much more contingent on how things actually happen, and they're subject to revision. So this is kind of the place where we would locate in a subjective Bayesian framework the laws of physics. We find that, if I assign some probability to the initial conditions of some particles, what probability should I assign to those particles at a later time? Well, that will encode Newton's laws, but it will be relating these two different contexts because time has passed, things have changed. It could have been that the laws were different. Mm-hmm.
So what if E doesn't happen? What do I do?
Well, that's fine. That's what's the problem.
Side until E happens, I'm a bit...
Yes, so as long as you're not receiving any new data or information, then basically all you can do is consider what you believe about what the events that you're anticipating might happen, and you can just coordinate your probabilities and make sure they're consistent. But until anything new happens, you're not going to
But what if the something new is e not, well, maybe I should say it this way. What if I something occurs such that I know E never will happen? Right? I'm trying to think of an example, but
if H happens, was H and E.
Well,
oh, no, not E, sorry, yeah, not E.
But
if
can you
E doesn't happen if I don't know, somebody's going to arrive at my house at 2:30 and they don't arrive at 2:30, then
sure.
I'd say E doesn't happen.
Yeah,
so
that you can in that case I would just put a little not sign here.
All right. And I put
that, if that's the notational thing, yeah.
You'd also have a probability like this one for naughty as well.
Well, that's what I'm
yeah,
thinking. You've
exactly.
got to have that, right?
Well, it's the same formula. It's, well, you just put the naughty here.
Yeah.
Whatever the relevant event is. So that your, you know, your new probability given some event or non-event has to be equal to your previous conditional probability conditional on that event or non-event. You know, you put in here whatever is the relevant thing you're considering. Mm-hmm. Oh, I have 5 minutes. Well, okay, perhaps I should go to questions. Let me just see if there was something important I wanted to say before the end. Okay, so maybe I'll make just a couple of comments about, let's say, anticipating a defense of the subjective Bayesian viewpoint. So I mentioned this normative aspect of coherence, which is normative because it's not enforced by any natural law that makes you believe these things, or you're not forced to be consistent in your beliefs. If you want to, you can make bets as if probabilities don't add up to one. But the basic premise of subjective probability that we should strive for coherence is based on the premise that that's what being human is all about. So sure, you don't have to strive for coherence, but probably you want to just because you're human and you like the world to make sense. It's worth contrasting the subjective Bayesian view to the idea that the world places no constraints whatsoever on an agent's subjective beliefs. Why can't you just make your probability assignments whatever you feel like? The answer to that is simply because of rules of this type. So because we admit of a notion of coherence in the world, in addition to our notion of internal coherence among our beliefs, there's essentially a doorway for the world to have its say. Things often happen that we don't want to happen or that we don't expect to happen. And in light of those things, we change our beliefs. It's a very natural thing to do. So the world does have a lot to say, and in particular, it's because of what the world does that we come up with these rules in the first place. The second objection might be that if everybody's probability assignments don't reflect actual true things about the world and just someone's subjective beliefs, doesn't that just mean there are no right or wrong beliefs and you have your truth and I have mine? So it's true that type 1 coherence, both types of coherence place strong constraints on your beliefs. So type 1 coherence tells you that your beliefs can be wrong if they're inconsistent with the other beliefs that you happen to hold within that same context. And type 2 coherence tells you that your beliefs can be wrong if you fail to update them in light of your experiences according to these rules that you've posited, in light of evidence. So finally, it can be proven as a theorem that provided that two agents have a certain minimal amount of common ground in their initial beliefs, And they both use Bayesian updating to update their beliefs when they get new evidence, that they will converge to the same probability assignments. In other words, sticking to these rules of coherence basically implies that a small amount of common ground between two agents gets magnified over time, such that they gradually come to agree with each other. So this so basically, coherence and more data leads to this magnification of agreement. So even though subjective Bayesianism begins by treating us all as kind of fundamentally isolated in our separate beliefs, it also provides the very mechanism whereby we're able to come to agreement. And by kind of bringing that into full light, it gives us some insight into how the scientific world is constructed. So we could even kind of say that this striving for coherence really embodies the scientific attitude, and it's this product of science is nothing else than the constitution of the unified world that we inhabit through this coming to agreement from different starting points.
Is what you're describing now the second bullet point of the, yeah, what cubism is, so.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I'm getting at. And that's where I'll end, I think. So thanks for listening.
So we had some questions already, but time for a quick question.
So it seems from the way you presented the updating that there is a special role to time. You're saying you have a belief at a certain time and then you update it when you get new information at a later time. So it seems somehow you need this some kind of external notion of time, and you cannot really put that into your system of beliefs.
So there, in cubism and subjective Bayesian generally, there's actually two times. There's the what I would call the lived time, which is this time that passes in which events actually happen. So they go from being possibilities to actualities. That's lived time. But then there's the what you might call anticipation time. So even when you're just considering your beliefs at one time, they might be beliefs about events that could happen at specific other times. So you might be saying, well, tomorrow it might rain. Well, that's a belief that I have right now in my lived time, but it's about something that I'm anticipating in the future, tomorrow. Similarly, you know, my memories might be involved here, or past events like, you know, who killed Caesar and so on. So you have to distinguish these two times, the sort of anticipation time, which is the arena of internal coherence, from the lived time, which is the arena of the
world. So would you say Bayesianism is incompatible with timeless formulations of physics?
Yeah, I would. Well, if it's compatible, it would have to be in a quite elaborate way, because the kind of a priori elements of subjective Bayesianism do presume that you have some subjective time. It's like one of the very first things that you're aware of. So if that doesn't end up appearing in your final description of scientific reality, you have to explain how it gets factored out.
Okay, let's thank Jeff again.